Hi, I'm Joshua Nove from Cognitive Science at Yale University.
I'm Molly Crockett from the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London.
So, in the media these days, there's been a lot of interest in the possibilities for neuropharmacology. So, it seems like traditionally we've just thought of pills as things that you could take, for example, if you had a disorder, for say depression, or if you had bipolar affective disorder. But recently, there's been this frenzy of thought that maybe pills can do something more, like that maybe we could have pills that would just make us into kinder, more compassionate, helpful people. And Molly, you've been doing a lot of the experiments that have been at the heart of this recent interest. I thought it'd be interesting to hear what you thought about these recent ideas about this kind of potential.
I get questions a lot about whether we could ever create a morality pill, for example. And I think it's a fascinating question. I've always been interested in the brain and how different chemicals in the brain influence our behavior and our emotions. So we've been doing some studies to see how one particular chemical called serotonin can influence people's moral judgment and their behavior. That said, I think we're probably a ways off from having a pill that you can pop before you meet your fiance's parents for the first time.
So, what have you found in your studies of serotonin?
So we've done a couple of things. One set of studies that we've done, we've been interested in how people respond to being treated unfairly and whether they're willing to retaliate or take revenge. So we use some games from that actually come from economics. One of them is called the ultimatum game. So you've got two players, a proposer and a responder, and they have to decide how to split a sum of money, or neither player gets any money. So the first guy, the proposer, suggests a way to make a split, and the second player, the responder, can either accept, in which case both players are paid those amounts, or he can reject, in which case the money disappears, neither gets anything. So what's interesting about this game is that, of course, even though something is better than nothing, if the responder thinks that he's been given an unfair deal, he's really likely to reject. And what we found is that if you shift around people's serotonin levels in the brain and their serotonin function, this can change the behavior of the responder. So some of the studies we've done, we've temporarily lowered serotonin levels by giving people this kind of nasty tasting drink that messes with their metabolism. And we find that when we lower serotonin, people are more likely to reject these unfair offers. And we find the opposite effect when we give them an antidepressant drug that works to enhance serotonin function in the brain. So we found this sort of lever that we can press around.
So if someone's taking an antidepressant drug and then you're wondering whether you can treat them badly and still get away with it, the answer is more yes than if they weren't taking that drug.
Potentially. So the study that we did was in the lab with healthy volunteers. So these were not depressed people. And they had never been depressed before. They had no one depressed in their family. So we're really sort of looking at what happened when we give people this antidepressant drug that sort of takes people from a baseline healthy normal serotonin function into maybe a situation where the brain is a little bit out of whack. That is a different kind of situation than someone who's depressed taking an antidepressant because their brain is in a sort of, well, I mean, it's an oversimplification, but a sort of low serotonin state to begin with, possibly. So it's hard to say, but like if someone's taking an antidepressant for health reasons, if they would respond like a normal person would when if they weren't on the drug, they would respond differently. Or if they are likely to more likely to forgive a bad deal. It's hard to say, but an interesting question, I think.
So if you do something bad to someone and now they have the option either to just accept it or to sort of make everyone's life worse as a result, then if you can do something that slightly boosts people's serotonin levels, they're more likely to just accept it.
Yeah, that's the result of one study that we've done.
And then if you just had to speculate, if you think about people who actually are depressed and so have maybe reduced serotonin levels for that reason, do you think they'd be especially likely maybe to choose the other option of just making things worse for everyone and retaliating?
That's certainly a possibility. There have been a few studies actually specifically looking at how depressed people play the ultimatum game. Mm-hmm. And the results are kind of mixed. So if you look at sort of not severely clinically depressed people, but sort of people who are borderline maybe showing some signs of depression, mm-hmm. there isn't, from what I can remember from what I've read, a very strong difference. I think actually they may accept sort of the same amount, but they report feeling worse about it. So mm-hmm. there's sort of this emotional difference. I've been collaborating with some people who are looking at behavior in this game in suicide attempters, elderly suicide attempters who are of course depressed, and they do look different from healthy people. It's an interesting effect that we find in this population. They seem to, first of all, they do reject a lot of the unfair offers, but we also vary sort of how expensive it is to reject. So you can imagine, like, if someone offers you like 10 cents out of a dollar, like, it's not really that expensive for you to reject that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if someone offers you $10 out of $100, then, like, that's getting to be more substantial amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be less likely to reject a higher amount than a lower amount if you sort of hold fairness constant. But what we see in some of these patient populations is that distinction is not really made. So, they sort of care about the fairness and don't really take into account, the expense of the rejection.
You know, it's an interesting question. It seems like a lot of times we're in this position where if someone screws you over, and then you're thinking, what should you do then? There'd be no reason to retaliate and just sort of destroy everything. But you somehow have to convey to the person that you would do that so that they won't screw you over in the first place. So maybe just making yourself in general seem like you're the kind of person who might commit suicide, you're a kind of a loose cannon, you do something weird at any moment, then people won't in the first place take the risk of maybe pissing you off.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly one major reason for why we see this kind of motivation is that, like, normally this can be a really beneficial and adaptive thing in the long run, mm-hmm. because you do want to get a reputation as someone that you don't want to treat poorly. What's interesting is that this strategy, but I don't know if it makes sense to call it a strategy, is that it applies in what we call one-shot games, which is what we use in the lab, where we get people to play ultimatum games with complete strangers who they don't know who they are, and they're never going to meet mm-hmm. them again. So there's no possibility for a reputation in these settings. But nonetheless, people still behave this way. So, I mean, it sort of gets into these really interesting questions about, like, well, do people do things because they're a habit, or... you know, you can think about behaviors that are adaptive or have been adaptive sort of throughout our evolutionary history, but don't make sense in the current context. So, like, our desire to eat fatty food, for example, you know, back in the days when food wasn't really readily available, like, it was a really, really good idea to consume as many calories as you could if they were right in front of you. But obviously now, when there's abundant calories everywhere, it's not as beneficial. And so, you know, you wonder if something like that is going on with rejection and ultimatum games. Like, it feels good in a way. Like, you know, revenge is satisfying. And it could have evolved to be that way because it was beneficial historically, even though it doesn't always pay in these lab situations that we create to probe.
So it seems like my best strategy would be if, when I'm really in public and everyone's watching, I take your disgusting drink that decreases my serotonin levels so that I just wildly retaliate and develop a reputation as someone that no one should mess with. But then when I'm in a private setting, just hanging out with you alone, then I drink the thing that gives me a high serotonin level so that I can be nice to you even if you do something mean to me, but no one will ever hear about it, and so my reputation for scariness or something won't be affected.
Exactly.
Well, but you know, it does seem as though, I have to say, I feel like I sort of managed to benefit a lot from the people who are scary in that way, because even if I never do anything scary, everyone's terrified to do something that might harm others, because they're worried about those few people who really will fly off the handle.
That's absolutely
so
true.
So it's kind of an altruistic act. The people who fly off the handle, at least they make things better for the rest of us, because then everyone is terrified about doing something terrible to us.
Yeah.
Because they think maybe we might be one of those people.
Yeah, that's absolutely a totally good point. And I think it brings up this really interesting question of, like, what is altruistic? So does something have to be altruistically motivated to be classified as altruistic? Because there are plenty of behaviors that sort of have effects that benefit other people. And I think, retaliation and something like an ultimatum game is definitely one of them. But probably when people are in the act of rejecting, they're not really thinking about, you know what, I'm going to do this to benefit other people.
Oh, right. You know, I was thinking, say there was some faculty member around here who always sort of took advantage of students. And then one day, one student just was like, I have had enough of this. I'm going to put an end to this. That might make things better for all of the other students.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be really unlikely that the student would be doing that in this altruistic purpose, thinking, by screaming or something, I'm going to be helping future generations of students.
Yeah, I mean, all of the evidence that we have on this kind of retaliatory behavior suggests that it's, like, really done in the heat of the moment. It's emotional, it's impulsive. And we found in another study, actually, that rejection in the ultimatum game correlates with a different measure of impulsivity. So would you rather have a small amount of money today as opposed to a larger amount of money after a delay? Like, people who prefer smaller money today are also more likely to reject unfair offers.
Do you think that people sort of pick up on that, so that if they're thinking about who to do something bad to, they would kind of think about in general how impulsive these seem? And the more impulsive, the more wary they would be of doing anything that harmed you.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if anyone's looked at that specifically, but that's certainly, I think, plausible. Like, again, going with, like, your reputation as, like, someone who's going to fly off the handle. Like, there's just this sort of, like, oh, you know, don't mess with this person.
So far we've been talking about serotonin and the idea that the higher your levels of serotonin, the less likely you are to fly off the handle and retaliate when someone does something that harms you. But a lot of the talk in the media these days isn't about serotonin so much as about oxytocin and the idea that this somehow is going to increase our interest in love and nurturance and make us kinder people. So what do you think about this kind of work?
Yeah, so I mean, oxytocin is really fascinating. I think that the original work on oxytocin by Tom and Sell and Larry Young, which showed that basically you have these two different species of voles, which are these little cute rodent things. They have very different patterns of oxytocin receptors in their brains, and those different patterns seem to correspond to whether the species is prone to forming monogamous pair bonds or not. And all of that work on oxytocin attachment is just beautiful, fascinating work. And more recently, it's been expanded to humans, where it's recently been possible to actually get people to sniff sort of a spray that has oxytocin in it, and this may have effects on the brain. The classic study that's been replicated many times and is just sort of a real landmark study was done by one of my mentors, Ernst Fehr, in Zurich, showing that if you give people oxytocin, it makes them more likely to trust another person in this financial sort of trust game where I get like $10 and I can send some of that money to a trustee, and if I send it, then it gets tripled or something like that. Then the trustee can send back any of that money to me, but he can also keep it all. So if I trust, then I could make more money than if I just keep the money. But there's also a risk that I don't actually get anything back. And so the question is, well, how likely am I to trust that the other person is going to send it back to me? And so it's a really beautiful game, because you can have a very good non-social control, which is basically a slot machine, where I can put the money in the slot machine that will pay out at a rate similar to what a trust person would do.
Oh, nice. And so oxytocin only impacts how you think about other people, not
exactly.
How you think about the machine.
Exactly. So it's a really beautiful study, because there's such a tight control there. And of course, people trust the other person more than they, quote unquote, trust the slot machine, right? And oxytocin selectively enhanced people's willingness to trust the person, but it didn't affect people's risk-taking behavior. And so
this same chemical makes bulls more monogamous and makes humans more trusting economically.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So, so that really, that study, really sparked a whole, you know, a huge, you know, deluge of studies on oxytocin. And, you know, a lot of them are consistent with this idea that oxytocin, you know, makes people more pro-social, I guess, is a good blanket term. But I mean, it's also, you know, the findings that come out of these studies also depend on where you look. And so, you know, a lot of the initial studies were on nice things like trust and generosity and, you know, sort of pro-social behaviors. But more recently, people have been looking at behaviors that are maybe not so nice. Like one big one is like ethnocentrism, or like preference for your own group at the expense of other groups. And what has been shown is that the sort of pro-social effects of oxytocin, like trusting and cooperation and stuff like that, tend to be stronger for your in-group, and that oxytocin may even like make you prefer your in-group and favor your in-group at the expense of the out-group. So that's maybe not so nice, fuzzy, warm kind of function of oxytocin. And I mean, I think sort of two things come out of this, right? So the first is that I think there's still a lot we don't know, and the whole landscape of what oxytocin does is still like, you know, it's unexplored. Like there are still things that we need to find out about it before we like jump to any conclusion about whether it's a moral molecule or not. But secondly, is that like, you know, you can't just cherry pick the nice pieces of data and like ignore the ones that are not so nice if you have some like grand thesis that, you know, oxytocin is going to make us all angels. So I think that a lot of the media hype that initially surrounded oxytocin, like I think it's starting to die down, and there are some really savvy science journalists out there who are starting to pick up on this more nuanced and, like, I think probably more interesting story about oxytocin.
Wait, so you're thinking that initial reports were, like, saying that oxytocin just makes us enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then this, what it actually seems to do, it seems like you're suggesting, is it makes us feel closer to certain other people, more trusting of them and so forth. But the downside of that is that insofar as we feel really embedded within a certain group or within a certain community, then for that reason, we sort of downgrade the importance we attribute to outgroup.
So yeah, that's one way to look at it. I don't think I really could give a one sentence description of like what oxytocin does in the context of social behavior. One thing that is clear is that like the context of the behavior itself does really seem to matter. So like oxytocin will make people more trusting in one situation, but not another situation. And there are these sort of moderating factors that haven't really been fully mapped out yet. So yeah, it's complicated, but I think, you know, one sort of broad idea is that oxytocin sort of makes social stuff more salient. So it's kind of could sort of put a spotlight on anything social that you're thinking about or processing or encountering in your environment.
Oh, so when making the social stuff more salient makes you more altruistic, then you'll become more altruistic. But when making the social stuff more salient makes you less altruistic, then maybe you become less altruistic.
Yeah, I think it could be something like that. But again, like, I think it's not totally clear, like, exactly the full range of what it does. And I mean, I think that makes sense in the case of serotonin as well. Like, these chemical systems in the brain are designed to do a lot of things. Like, you know, serotonin, for example, is involved not just in social behavior, but it's involved in sleep, it's involved in appetite, it's involved in mood, it's involved in like movement, it's involved in lots of stuff. And that's because, like, these chemicals are all over the brain, and depending on where in the brain they're acting, they're going to do different things.
You know, I can really see already a sort of, I feel like the sense of foreboding about your thesis that if I imagine two people standing up at, like, Society for Neuroscience, and one person says, oxytocin is the moral molecule, it's going to make us into angels. And then you stand up later and you say, you know, these are very complex issues. We haven't yet fully understood all the moderators of these effects. And then I'm, like, wondering which is going to be the newspaper the next day.
Yeah.
I kind of have, like, this foreboding that it's unlikely to be, like, new study reveals things are more complex than the
initial assumption. Yeah, it's a real tension, I think, for all of science, is that, you know, the truth is that a lot of our data is really quite complex. And, you know, I mean, if you're studying something like social behavior or the brain, like, it should be complex. If you got a really simple, a really, really simple explanation, like, maybe check your code to make sure you didn't make an error, you know.
But, you know, maybe there's something about this particular explanation that's really drawing people. So the idea that within our minds there are these different forces, and that one of them is something like the good one, and mm-hmm. one of them is like the bad one,
yeah.
seems much more appealing somehow than it. There's this single force within our minds, and what it does is, depending on the context, it in some cases creates the morally good behaviors, and sometimes it creates the morally bad ones. There's something I feel like people would find deeply unintuitive about that.
Mm.
It's like maybe if you imagine two religions and one said something like, there are two deities, the good one and the bad one. And then another one said, there are two deities, you know, the one that moves you toward more social things and the one that moves you toward less social things. And then the second one said, you know, well, depending on the situation, sometimes the one deity would be make you more good and sometimes the other one would.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like I can already tell which religion is going to win out.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way.
So, maybe
but
even
yeah,
controlling for simplicity.
Yeah.
Even if the two were equally simple, there's something really compelling about the idea that there's something in our mind that's like the good part.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's parallel with, you know, what books and movies are about, right? So, I mean...
Oh, that there would be
villains
in like some terrible movie, there'd be like two opposing forces, like the good one and the bad one.
Yeah.
But there wouldn't even... It's not just a matter of simplicity, because it might be sort of complicated to figure out which is the good thing and which is the bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
You could... If you imagined there are two opposing forces and one always moves toward one thing and one always moves toward the other thing,
mm-hmm.
and then just depending on the situation, sometimes the one will be the good one and sometimes the other will be the good one. That just doesn't have the same, that's not what, you know, the movie is going to be about.
Yeah. Yeah, because it requires online evaluation. And I mean, it's more efficient to just have rules that we can follow.
But, you know, I think speaking of this question about good and bad, this research that you're talking about, it raises these really important questions, I mean, about how we should actually live. So it seems like, you know, there were these old stories that had this kind of vaguely science fictional air, like Brave New World or Clockwork Orange or something,
mm-hmm.
in which people were able to control human behavior in some way, and then it raised certain kind of just purely hypothetical kind of moral issues, like whether we should do that. But now we're in a very different position. I mean, we actually could get people to sniff oxytocin a lot. We could get people to take SSRIs. And the work by you and by others is showing that this really changes people's behavior in important ways. So what do you think? I mean, do you think that these things actually could in some ways have a kind of value in making our society a better place, or is there a reason not to do that?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, I hope that at some point the work that we're doing can make a difference. But I think it is a really complicated question because, you know, at some point someone has to decide, well, what kinds of behaviors do we want to promote, and what is moral? And, you know, I mean, I mean, a lot of people have spent a lot of time talking about whether science can tell us what is right or wrong. And I think, you know, I get really nervous when people ask me that question because I don't feel like I have a very, very good answer for it at the moment.
Well, just thinking about it, I mean, to whatever degree we can, it seems like when you decrease people's serotonin levels, you make it that they are more retaliating when someone treats them badly. When you increase their serotonin levels, they're making it that people are less retaliate and are more, I don't know, forgiving in a certain sense when someone treats them badly. So, at least intuitively, it seems like there would be some situations where we would value the one kind of response and some kind of situations where we'd value the other kind of response. So, would there be certain kinds of cases in which it might actually seem helpful in some particular context to try to, you know, give people tryptophan or give people SSRIs or something to change their serotonin levels in such a way that they're actually going to more retaliate or less retaliate?
Yeah, I mean, one thing about retaliation is that it's a destructive force, right? So, like, neither person is better off, really, like, in the long run. I mean, you could argue that the person who does the retaliating is better off because, like, they chose to do that. So obviously there was some value function in their brain that said retaliating is preferable to not retaliating.
Well, no, but they could be better off just because no one will do that to them again.
Yeah.
Say that someone's husband is treating her really badly. You decrease her serotonin levels, and then instead of accepting that treatment, she just says, you know, you can't treat me like that.
Yeah.
Maybe in the next year, it won't happen.
Yeah, that is a really good idea. I was thinking more the opposite end, which is if you could make people less retaliatory, it might facilitate like mediation processes or negotiations where, you know, you have certain, I think, situations where one party has wronged another party, like, I don't know, maybe in a civil lawsuit, like you're trying to negotiate a settlement or something, and like,
and then before you can sit down at the negotiating table, you each take SSRI.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of controversial, but I think that if we feel like we've been wronged, like those emotions and the desire just to see the other person suffer, even if nothing good comes out of it, can probably cloud people's judgments about like maybe what they wish had happened after the fact. So like I think one feature of the motive for retaliation is that it's there in the heat of the moment, but it's not necessarily long lived. So
right, like in my example about marriage, it seems like in the particular case I mentioned, maybe it would be good to retaliate, but probably almost always it's not. It's almost always better if people would try to come to an understanding. And if they could become, maybe each person feels a little bit wronged, but also each person values not just retaliating, but managing to reconcile. And when you're trying to reconcile, maybe you'll be better off if your serotonin levels are elevated.
Yeah, maybe.
Or if we consider the case of oxytocin, are there certain kind of cases where you think potentially it might be good to increase or decrease it, if we would actually be better off if people's oxytocin levels were higher or lower?
Well, so one thing that has been proposed, I think, is in certain kinds of therapy, like developing a close and trusting relationship with your therapist is a really important component of getting better. And this is particularly difficult in certain disorders like borderline personality disorder or some forms of social anxiety, where the person's problem is that they can't trust other people. And so how do you get a therapist to help you if you can't trust your therapist. And so I think some people are exploring like giving oxytocin to these patients like at the beginning of therapy so they can form a bond with their therapist so then they can go through and do this sort of cognitive behavioral therapy.
I didn't process. Know that. Is that legal?
Yeah, as far as I know. I read an article about it I can't remember who. But about a year ago, I think.
Oh, so, and then I wonder, like, with each of these kinds of things, I could imagine someone thinking, even if it did work, that there'd be something wrong with it. I mean, not something about it having bad consequences, but just that they would feel on some deeper level that there's something creepy, even if people do get better as a result.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this comes up a lot, right? It's like questions of authenticity. So, I mean, for example, you know, in a sort of different but related domain, if you take a pill that helps you focus and you do really well on a test, do you deserve that success? Like, is that a real success or is it fake? Like, it feels kind of fake, right? It feels like, oh, it wasn't me that did well on that test. It was the pills that I took that did well on that test.
You're like the Lance Armstrong of test taking.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, these are really, really deep and interesting questions, I think. At the end of the day, like, whatever authentic process happens, like, if I'm trusting someone, like, that is a chemical process that's taking place in my brain. And if we can replicate that, suppose that we could identically replicate that experience and, like, you know, we could pinpoint like exactly what chemicals and where in the brain, like the experience of trusting your therapist, comes from. And then we could take a patient who lacks that, you know, who has a deficit there and replicate that perfectly. Then if you were just looking at the brain, you wouldn't be able to tell who's the patient and who's the healthy person. And so then like, that's an interesting question then, right? Like, well, is the experience of the patient less real because like the source of it is a pill rather than like generated by their brain?
Well, but it's not that the experience is less real per se, it's that it's less really an experience of that person. So suppose that you're trying to enter into a really deep and close relationship with a particular person, and then we give them some kind of pharmaceutical intervention that makes them more trusting, and then you have a closer relationship.
Yeah.
Then you certainly had a closer relationship with someone. Mm-hmm. But now, if we've changed that person's brain in some important way, is it that the worry is something like, is it really that it's that very person, and you just developed a closer relationship with that person, or is it that you developed a closer relationship just by eliminating what was made that person uniquely that person as opposed to someone else?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this gets at the idea of what do we count as part of the self, right? So, like, is the ability to trust, is that core to someone's identity and their self, or is that just something that is layered on top? And like, if you took that away, you're still the same person.
Yeah, you know, this is really interestingly different, it seems, from the question that you see, say, with something like Adderall. Mm. It seems like if I got to be better at paying attention, it seems like it would really clearly still be me, just me, only a little bit better at paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
But if you took someone who was a very not trusting person and gave them medication that made them more trusting, it's not quite as clear somehow that what you'd be doing is, you know, preserving the essence of what made that person him or herself, but just adding a little bit of trust.
Yeah.
It seems somehow more in this case that you're intervening on something at the very essence of what makes this person herself. In a way that if you were affecting their ability to pay attention, their intelligence, their memory, these things seem so much less connected with the essence of what makes the person that person that she is.
Yeah, I think I agree, actually, which is, that's a really good observation. And it sort of makes me think, well, like, why is that? Like, what is special about like these social and moral characteristics that seem to be more essential to a person's identity than like these more cognitive, characteristics.
Yeah, it is a very striking phenomenon. I mean, there was a nice study about this recently using a kind of fictional thought experiment by Nina Strominger and Sean Nichols. Mm-hmm. What they did is they asked, what if you entered into someone else's body?
Mm-hmm.
And then what things about you would be retained and which things would be lost? So to say you, like, came into and then appeared in the body of, like, Bill O'Reilly. So now Bill O'Reilly has you within him.
Oh, my God.
Then what would be the, what would, so would you still, for, would that new person, say, have the same intellectual abilities that you now have? A lot of people think, no, you know, maybe you'd have a Bill O'Reilly's, like, much lower intellectual abilities. Or would you have the same memories? Would you have the same kind of physical abilities? But then if you asked about your moral character, everyone thinks it would be you. That's the thing that would sort of be changed when you enter this other person's body. This person's moral character would be sort of transformed.
Oh, interesting.
It seems like there's some sense that we think of your moral character as being at the heart of who you are, whereas your talents and abilities and so forth are not at all.
That's really interesting.
But so, you know, it seems like when we started out, we were talking about this idea that we see in the media of this sort of sense that maybe there's some pill that will just make you a good person or something like that. And as we keep talking about it, it seems like the main thing that's coming out of this is just that it's so infinitely more complex than anything that these newspaper articles would have sort of portrayed for us.
Yeah, I agree.
So maybe, I don't know, the best answer to our initial question about whether these will make us a better person is just, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think that's really refreshing because, I mean, part of science is, or really the whole point of science is to figure stuff out, but it's an incremental process. So, you know, we are constantly gathering different bits of evidence to get us closer to an understanding of how stuff works. But if you're to stop any scientist on the street at any point of time and be like, hey, tell me about your most recent study and how is that the answer to everything in the space that you study, like, the correct answer is, I don't know, because, you know, we're trying to figure this stuff out. It's really complicated and it's a process.
So we should not say we don't know with like an air of resignation and defeatism. We should say we don't know proudly with an air of reaffirming the most central values of science.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so with that, let's just affirm our ignorance. And
yes, we don't know.
Thanks so much, Molly.
Thanks.